Good morning. We'll call a meeting of the Joint Committees of Agriculture, Finance, and Policy to order. Have a full agenda this morning, and I believe we do have enough for a quorum, although we don't take any official action at these joint meetings. But I want to welcome, first of all, this morning. Saw the bright badges this morning at breakfast, so welcome to the Morrow Program, new class. I think this is their third get-together of their two-year commitment. So come on down, whomever is going to speak with us and talk to us about the Minnesota Agriculture Leadership Program. The surname is Myrl. Good morning and welcome to all of you. And I assume somebody is going to come up and speak to us. Here we go. Good morning, sir. Have a chair at the microphone and identify yourself for the record and tell us about yourself and about the program.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Patrick O'Connor. I am a sixth-generation family farmer from Blooming Prairie, Minnesota. We raise corn, soybeans, and we also have hogs. I became involved in the Morrow program. My dad was a previous member, so I got to know about it through him, and he strongly encouraged me to apply, so I did. And this is our third meeting. Basically, what we've been covering so far is a lot about learning about ourselves and what makes us who we are as a part of our emotional intelligence and our personality. And from what I'm gathering out of it, you need to know who you are before you identify who you want to become as it relates to a leader. And that's kind of where we're at now. So now we're at the state capitol learning about leadership at the capitol level and the democratic process.
Very good. Ma'am, good morning.
Good morning.
State your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Katie Scheider, and I am originally from Delano, Minnesota, and I just recently moved to Maplewood. I grew up on my family's hobby farm. We raised about 45 sheep and did feeder lambs. I currently work in agriculture finance for a company called Pro Partners Financial, and I work on agricultural loans and underwriting and those types of things. I joined Marl hoping to expand my horizons on the agricultural industry in Minnesota, especially as it relates to diversity and immigration in this field. I'm also, you know, interested in developing my leadership skills, which we have done a ton of, you know, not only bonding among the class, but getting to see how Marl has grown other leaders throughout the, you know, 9 years it's been around. I'm really excited about this opportunity, and we get to go to Washington, D.C. and learn more about policy and whatnot, and just a very exciting opportunity for us to emerge as leaders in the agricultural industry.
Very good. Thank you. And I assume one more. Good morning. State your name for the record and tell us about yourself.
Good morning. My name is Heidi Peterson, and I am from Stillwater, Minnesota. I'm excited to be here today as part of the cohort for Marl. And a big reason why I wanted to become part of the Marl program is Minnesota is a diverse state, and we can learn a lot from each other. And so the networking opportunities that we've been able to establish already in this third meeting are just outstanding, because as I stated, Minnesota is very diverse. And so the type of agriculture that we have within this part of the state is very different than what we may see down toward Lamberton or up toward the Red River Valley. And so this is an excellent opportunity to learn from each other and to build that network and to have others that we can reach out to have questions answered and to be there when we need assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could the other members of the class, just where you are, stand up briefly and your name, where you're from, and your connection to agriculture, please? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jornick. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, and I live in Falcon Heights.
I'm Ashley Schreiner. I'm from Blue I worked for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute for 27 years, and I also live on an active grain farm, or crops farm, farming with my husband and brother-in-law and father-in-law.
Mark Enengay from Rochester, Minnesota, and I also farm in Fulda, Minnesota as well. I work for a pharmaceutical company called Boehringer Ingelheim. They manufacture vaccines and antibiotics for animals. And as I mentioned, I farm in Fulda with my parents on a fourth generation farm, raise corn and soybeans, and have a cow-calf operation.
My name is Joe Palsma. I live in Edgerton, Minnesota, where I farm near there in Chandler with my father. I raise cattle, hogs, and sheep, and also crops as well, corn, soybeans, oats, alfalfa, cover crop mixes, and I graze grazing mixes for grass-fed beef and also hogs.
My name is Paul Wright from Hutchinson. I'm a crop and dairy farmer as well as service on the McLeod County Commission.
My name is Adam Ulrich. I come from Melrose, Minnesota. I currently work for United Farm Credit Services, where I serve as communications specialist.
I'm in Kirtley, and I am with the Minnesota Agriculture Council under Director of Membership, and we work to create a positive business climate for agriculture.
I'm Jason Garms. I work for the Minnesota DNR as our agriculture program liaison, and I also operate our fourth generation farm in Jackson County, Minnesota.
I'm Brad Newman. I'm from Wabasso, Minnesota, Redwood County. I'm a third-generation Spartan boy, and then I also work for Land O'Lakes for the cropland seed brand in Redwood County.
Hi, my name is Steve Hoffman from New Ulm. I am a fifth-generation dairy farmer. Farm with a son that has just come home from college very recently, and another son that's in college that I'd like to join the operation too. And just would like to say, thanks for the opportunity to give us recognition.
Is that all of it?
We're missing some that are on legislative.
Okay. Well, thank you much. Welcome to all of you, and enjoy your time here at the state capitol. And just a quick question for the fellow from Bloom and Prairie we met in the elevator this morning. You're a sixth generation family farmer. That goes back a long ways. When did your farm actually get started?
Our farm was settled in 1858, right on the banks of the Cedar River in Blooming Prairie.
Wow. That's quite a record. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And keep it going.
I hope so.
Hey, again, these are some challenging times in agriculture, but with leadership like you are learning and will be using in the years ahead, the future is good, still good for agriculture here in Minnesota. Again, thank you much for being with us today. Moving on now, we have a couple of presentations that should be interesting from the department. And first up is the Advanced Biofuels Report. And Andrea? Okay, very good. So come on down. And I believe you have a couple of these in your packets, hard copies, but we'll get the report from the Department of Agriculture. Good morning. Identify yourselves, and let's go.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Bobble. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And with me today is Bob Patton. He is the manager of our Energy and Environment section within our Ag Marketing and Development Division. So thank you so much for having us today. So we actually have a PowerPoint. I think you might have copies in front of you. Otherwise, maybe it's up. Maybe not.
Tyler.
I thought I saw it up there before, but no big deal. There we go. There we go. We were just going to do a basic overview of the state of biofuels in Minnesota. I actually was just going to start with biodiesel, if that's okay. And then we'll go through each one, and please stop with questions if you have any. We're happy to answer any questions that we can. So this is based upon a report to the legislature that was due earlier this week, written by our biofuels manager, Kevin Hennessy, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, so we're here in his place. So just a quick refresher on what biodiesel is, for those of you who aren't familiar. Biodiesel is a renewable, clean-burning diesel replacement that is made from a diverse mix of feedstocks, including recycled cooking oil, soybean oil, and animal fats. It's made through a chemical process where renewable oil is reacted with an alcohol to produce methyl esters, which is what biodiesel is, and glycerin, which is a byproduct that can be used for other products, including soaps. We currently have three biodiesel plants in Minnesota. REG, or Renewable Energy Group, Albert Lea, is in Albert Lea, Minnesota. The Minnesota Soybean Processors have a crushing plant in Brewster, Minnesota. And then Evercat Fuels is located in Isanti, Minnesota. Minnesota's biodiesel nameplate production capacity is at 63 million gallons. Feedstocks are mostly determined by the price and availability of the oil or fat that can be used in the the process of making biodiesel. Given the large soybean oil crushing capacity we have in Minnesota, much of the soy oil used in Minnesota biodiesel plants are likely to be sourced from Minnesota soybean producers. The supply of biodiesel fuel to Minnesota terminals has been relatively constant. When B5 and B10 outages occur, it's not generally due to the unavailability of the biodiesel, but because of maintenance of equipment or short delivery delays. To give you just a quick timeline of the biodiesel mandate in Minnesota, in 2005, Minnesota became the first state to implement legislation mandating the use of biodiesel fuel in its diesel fuel supply at a level of 2%, or what we call B2. May 1st, 2009, the mandate increased to B5, or level of 5%. And July 1st, 2014, it increased to B10. B10 is in effect for the summer months, April through September, and B5 is used during the winter months, October through March. And then we are scheduled May 1st of 2018. The mandate is scheduled to move to B20 for the summer months, which I'll get to later. We do have what's called the Biodiesel Task Force in place. It was created by the legislature in 2003 to help carry out the biodiesel mandate. We meet on an ad hoc basis to discuss issues related to biodiesel production and its use here in Minnesota. We do have some sub-teams and subcommittees that can form to address more specific issues such as cold weather operability. And they are appointed by the Commissioner of Agriculture. We have a number of sectors that are represented on the task force, including education research institutions, farm organizations and grower groups, oil and fat processors, the petroleum industry, fuel user groups, and environmental groups. And in the report that was submitted to you just a few days ago, we do have the specific names of those who are on the biodiesel task force as of right now. So biodiesel in Minnesota beyond, as I mentioned, we are mandated to look at B20 in 2018. Four conditions need to be met by statute to move to B20. We need an ASTM standard that exists, and that's just a general standard body that does exist right now. So that condition is met. We need sufficient supply to 50% or more demand, adequate statewide blending infrastructure, and 5% supply from alternative feedstock. In order for us to determine whether those have been met, we must convene a meeting of the Biodiesel Task Force, who will make a recommendation and advise the three commissioners of Agriculture, Pollution Control Agency, and Commerce, and they will make the ultimate determination on whether the state is ready to move to B20. And that's biodiesel. I can pause there or just keep going if anyone has any questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Lowell. When do you expect that to occur, the determination?
We're required to do it by May 1st of 2018. So we're in talks right now just looking at where we are as a state, and we're working towards that as statute dictates. So I would say it would be around May that we'll make that determination and have the commissioners meet to make that final say.
Okay. Yeah. Further questions? Could you back up the slide to the previous one? In that second bullet point, is sufficient supply to 50% of demand? Why not 100%? Or why? What does that 50% actually mean?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Bob Patton. It's really to allow that there is import of soy from other states. So over 50% would come from Minnesota.
Okay. Go ahead.
So just a quick overview of the Minnesota Bioincentive Program. So an overview of that is in the 2015 legislative session, production incentive payments for the manufacture of advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass thermal energy production was put into place. We were appropriated $500,000 within the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation, or the AGRI program, which you heard about from Commissioner Fredrickson yesterday, for payments in FY16 and $1.5 million for payments in FY17. An eligible producer may receive payment per unit of production with minimum production levels required to be eligible for the program. There is a maximum amount that can be claimed in 1 year, and a producer may collect payments through the program for 10 years. The program is set to end in 2035. To date, no claims for payment have been made. How we do it is claims are made January 31st, April 30th, July 31st, or October 31st, and they report on their previous 3 months. So as of October 31st, we haven't received any claims. I can't say if we will in January 31. However, we are aware of a number of companies who are making business decisions based upon this program and plan on taking advantage. So we think it's a really good investment, and we think it'll be utilized quite frequently in the coming years. Just a quick update. We did create a website on our MDA website that summarizes the program's and its three components. As I mentioned before, advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass thermal energy production. And we are producing a brochure that can be used at trade shows or other events to just educate folks that this program exists, and we hope that they'll utilize it. That's all I've got on that, if anyone has any questions.
Representative Kunish Bodine. Martin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. What is that website, please?
Sure. I can send it to you. I don't have it listed right here, but it's on our website, so I can send you the link.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Go on, Ms. Bob.
There was a report that was listed. It's not due until February 1st, so we're still completing that, but I thought we would give a quick update on the Minnesota Biofuels Infrastructure Partnership Program. A lot of you probably know it as BIP. So I'm just going to do a quick overview on that, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. So the BIP program is a grant program for retail biofuels infrastructure, which is pumps and tanks, funded by the USDA, the state of Minnesota, and private sector partners for the primary purpose of increasing consumption of biofuel in the form of ethanol. Eligible projects under this program, E15, E25 retrofits of existing gasoline pumps, new E15 pumps, blender pumps capable of dispensing E85, E15, and other mid-level ethanol blends, dedicated E85 pumps, underground storage tanks, and above-ground bulk storage for ethanol. The breakdown of the funding, we did leverage funds from our partners in the state, which leveraged $8 million from the USDA. That's how much was allocated to us by USDA. The state put up $3.55 million. We used $3.05 million from AGRI, and then the $500,000 that was appropriated by the legislature for E15 last session. Our partners include the American Lung Association, Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council, the Minnesota Biofuels Association, and 17 Minnesota ethanol plants, and that includes cash and in-kind services to leverage that $8 million. Just a quick timeline. So we submitted our application to USDA in July of 2015. In September, we got our grant award of $8 million and signed our initial contract with USDA. We sent out an RFP based on the federal contract in December of 2015, and then it closed in February of 2016. In March 2016, we sent out our award offers, and we started our contract negotiations. In September of 2016 was the second RFP that we put out for E15 retrofits only, and then October 2016 was our third RFP based upon just blender pumps, and those closed in November of 2016. Another date that I just wanted to bring up as well is that May 19th at 10:35 a.m., we heard from a major retailer that they were backing out last minute. So that was a huge piece of how this whole program rolled out. So the results to date are from that first RFP, that initial RFP that we released back in December of 2015. We funded 43 stations, 200 pumps, 20 underground tanks, and two above
above-ground storage tanks for EPC blending. So you'll see there that USDA, is that's how much money we allocated from USDA, our match, and then the partner match. And that's the end of my presentation. So I'm happy to answer any specific questions on that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you remind me who your partners are again?
Absolutely.
Ms. Bottle?
American Lung Association, Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council, Minnesota Biofuels Association, and 17 ethanol plants. That did include cash and in-kind services.
Representative Clark. Are you done, Representative Johnson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you talk a little bit more about the Minnesota Lung Association's involvement and what their rationale is?
Absolutely. They've been a fantastic partner for us. They are huge proponents of the use of ethanol for the clean air side effects of ethanol use. So they actually helped with releasing the RFP, answering questions, helping develop who received, how we were going to determine who received the grant funding, and then ultimately helping us negotiate contracts.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
So is there data that is being collected to that rationale?
Absolutely, yes, and we can send that to you.
Further questions? Ms. Babel, yeah, you mentioned the one party backing out, and I have read or heard that we did utilize about $4 million of that total. Any chance of an extension, or we could try to get some of the money back and to have a second go around?
Yes, yes. So as I said, we were quite devastated that major retailer backed out last minute. They had agreed to 49 stations originally, which would have been a significant impact on the ethanol industry in Minnesota. So we did attempt all summer to try and get them back involved in the program. Unfortunately, we were unsuccessful. So that is why we released the second and third RFPs. We, because of the work of our partners, and particularly the Minnesota Biofuels Association, who worked hard to recruit other stations to be involved and submit applications for these second and third RFPs, we did have 49 new stations that applied for this funding. We were originally, USDA had asked that we had all construction completed by December 31st of 2016. We reminded them that unlike Florida and Texas, we have winter here, so that wasn't going to work for us. And so they did allow us to extend construction to be completed at the end of this year. So we are continuing to offer awards to those 49 stations and are in current contract negotiations with them. We feel good that we can spend a large chunk of that funding as part of what USDA allocated for us.
So you're saying that you can still...
Yes. Yep. So we're okay. Still working on contracts with those folks, and I can't tell you exactly who, you know, how many gallons will be affected or how much money that will be spent at this point, just because we're still working on finalizing those negotiations. But we're going to continue to work hard to try and recruit folks to use that funding.
Good. That was an excellent program. Well, we got great funding from USDA and good partnerships from the state and the private entities, and. You know, we've gone past this blend law. I think we're up to like 12% ethanol usage in the state, and it's programs like this that have made that possible. So thank you for your work in that, and let's keep going with it.
Absolutely.
Thank you
very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, and that's all I've got.
Oh, okay. So you've run through all three of your
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, all three of the reports. Most of them were just quick overviews or just quick updates. You know, some of the specifics, you know, we could really, it's mostly just a reminder of, you know, rack pricing, RINs, cold weather operability, that kind of thing, which wasn't anything new.
Question from Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you brought up the cold weather thing, question popped into my mind. Northern Minnesota, our agriculture industry is harvesting trees, and last year we had a rather mild winter, so I didn't hear much from our logging operators, but there has been a big concern over the years of the biodiesel gelling issue, especially when logging trucks and or the equipment sits out overnight. So I've just like an update on where we're at on the gelling issue with biodiesel, and so when they ask me, I can tell them that it's being worked on. Thank you.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, we can certainly provide you more information on that. I think at this point, we do luckily have something called the diesel helpline that is free, that folks can call and report issues that they have with their just biodiesel or just regular diesel or ethanol, whatever biofuel they're having an issue with. They can report that, and we'll follow up on that. Not us specifically, but someone will follow up on that. So I encourage, and if you hear any folks who have issues, to call that helpline. But that is something that we're continuing to monitor and look at. As of right now, we do have just B5 in the winter months. But again, we'll continue to look at that as technologies evolve.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did pass that number out rather freely last year, so I assume there were some calls into it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But as I understand, doesn't logging have an exemption from the biodiesel?
Mr. Chair, I believe that to be true, but I'd have to double check on that.
Okay. Yeah, there were several industries, I believe railroads and logging and Coast Guard ships had an exemption from the
Mr. Chair, that's correct, yes.
Yeah, biodiesel. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm looking at the handout, one of the handouts here. Quickly, I know there's a more complicated answer to this, but what drives the fluctuation in diesel prices here in Minnesota? So I'm seeing some big fluctuations over the past few years. What's the main determiner? Is it our biofuel sector and its elements, or is it something else?
That's a who wants to handle that question?
That's a 30-second answer, Mr. Chair, I'm sure. Maybe the better question is, what should we be paying attention to relative to that reality as legislators?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, do you mean specifically diesel or biodiesel? Just regular diesel?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm thinking there's a close relationship between both of those. So tell me what you think I should know relative to biodiesels.
Ms. Vabel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani. I think I would say, you know, in just regards to biodiesel, for what you should know, I think it's a really important investment that the state makes, and I think we should continue to make it in the biodiesel industry. I think its elements and its value in additional markets for farmers is really important to our agricultural sector. So I would say to just keep apprised of what's going on with that on the federal level as well, and that, you know, if you have any additional questions, to please reach out to us.
And I would just add also that some of the pricing things beyond our scope, there had been a $1 a gallon blender's credit.
Yep. That's correct.
And that's been that was not extended this year.
Right.
And so at a 5% blend, that amounts to about a nickel a gallon. Mm-hmm. There's also a very complicated program of RINs, the certificates, and I still don't totally understand those. And that's a buy and sell program based on your production.
Right.
And that has an impact on the price as well. So a lot of things that impact the pricing. Generally speaking, I think there isn't a big difference in pricing with the plain diesel or biofuel diesel right now. But, of course, soybeans are cheap right now, too. And so good question. And we do have plenty of time left, so I'd encourage more questions from the committee. And Mr. Sullivan did the look up in the statute book, and there are exemptions for logging and locomotives, things like that, for bio. But I will say on the gelling aspect, we did go through some growing pains when it first came, the B5, and I think the bio has a tendency to clean out tanks and fuel systems, and we had a tough winter. It was a cold winter and a lot of filter issues, and believe me, it's no fun to change a diesel filter when it's 20 below zero. It's not a fun thing. But I haven't heard many or any complaints in the last couple of years. We've had mild winters, but I think the ASTM standards have been improved, and the bio is more consistent, and the product is up to a top quality. And my opinion would be that I don't think we're going to have the problems we had before, even going to the higher blend. and especially with the blink off from October through the winter months, going back to a B5. So the B20 is set to go, and the production is there, and the commissioner of Commerce and Agriculture will make those determinations, and then it'll be a 270-day waiting period or something like that, and then it goes into effect possibly by next year. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, a question about biodiesel. I have heard that it's considered that it... No, it's not doing. Anyway, I've heard that it's kind of considered that it adds about a dollar to the value of a bushel of soybeans. How is that determined? Has that been determined? Am I correct in that assumption, or
Ms. Bobble?
No.
Mr. Chair, committee members, no. We were talking about that this morning. We don't have that data, but you're probably in the ballpark.
Representative Johnson.
And then on another subject, the biomass. You just briefly spoke about the nuances of securing interest in working with biomass in for fuels and other chemicals and that sort of thing. You know, I'm deeply interested in this. Can you give us a little more detail? Can you give us some hint of where some of the most promising opportunities are? And then also, maybe speak to the working lands proposal, the funding that was done last session that helps, that Bowser is using to develop processes and looking at watersheds where this can work well and the water quality benefits. Maybe expand on that part of the presentation a little bit.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson.
Ms. Bobble.
I would say that we do. I know of specifically two companies that are working towards meeting the eligibility requirements, and they're quite close. I don't know that I can publicly say them at this point, but I do know that they're very close, and that there are a number of other companies making business decisions on coming to Minnesota based upon the fact that this program exists. So that's why I'm just not able to expand too much on it, just because I don't want to get out in front of those companies. But I think it's a really positive thing for economic development here in Minnesota. As far as the working lands, I'm not too familiar with it. Maybe Bob can take this.
Mr. Patton, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The Working Lands Initiative, we just had a meeting recently with Bowser staff to coordinate that, as you are mentioning, their charge is to develop a report on uses of perennials and cover crops to promote those. At the same time, what we're charged with within the bioincentive program is the companies that come in are going to need to submit plans that they responsibly source their materials. So this is true of all three of them, and there are some more stringent requirements that apply to the advanced biofuels. They need to have their required percentages. There's a ramping up of the percentages of perennials and cover crops. So those are provisions we've been researching and looking at. And so when those companies come in, we'll have the responsibility of reviewing the plans that are submitted, and we'll be submitting a report to the legislature about those.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And it seems to me, just a couple of comments. One, it seems to me the incentives that are involved here with the program are helping attract those industries. Is that a fair statement?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Johnson, yes, I would say so.
Were you done?
No. One more. I just want to make a comment. What I find interesting, and it kind of fits to the culture of this committee, but also to agriculture. But what's interesting with both the biodiesel and the incentives for the Working Lands Project is the very positive mix of actors who are supporting it. We heard about the biodiesel, the role of the American Lung Association, along with agriculture. It brings together multiple sectors towards to secure multiple benefits. I think likewise with the working lands, we saw that was really supported by major environmental groups, the corn growers, the farmers union, and other farm groups, and the biofuels industry itself. When there's multiple partners from multiple sectors, and I think the reason that they're getting after these programs. Is that there's multiple benefits, and I think everybody in this room, I think we appreciate that when we take action and we can see benefits in multiple sectors and in multiple ways, and this is dealing with health and it's dealing with the environment and promoting agriculture, that's the kind of legislation and the kind of progress that we can make in Minnesota that has real meaning in multiple sectors, and the overall positive dynamic of that I think is significant and merits recognition.
Very good. And Representative Johnson, I happened to speak to some of the soybean folks a couple of days ago and talking about the step up to B20 and such. And they said that the value of the biodiesel of soybean to the soybean market is about 67 cents a bushel is what they said. And I don't know how they came up with that, but that's the number that they gave to us. Any other discussion, comments, items? Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, you asked for some more questions, so I'll put a couple of them here. The bio-incentive program, is it limited just to fuels? It's not. Okay. So,
right. I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, it would be advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and then the biomass.
So, Mr. Chairman, I know we heard it, and I can't remember if it was this committee or environment committee, about alternatives to petroleum products, for example, asphalt, alternatives from the agricultural sector. I think it was soybeans that could be used to create a product that can help keep our roads. Mm. We can renew the roads. We don't need to put down more asphalt. Is that something that is part of anything that you're doing with these bio-incentives, or is that something that could be eligible? Or?
Ms. Bobble?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, Bob has said, yes, they would be eligible. I'm not aware of anything that we're currently working on, but it's something that would be eligible that we would look at if there was a company that approached us.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, if I
could... Representative Clark.
I'd like to encourage that, and maybe you could let me know what you find out. One of the issues that comes up, I represent an inner city area, and that issue is important to us because of the fact that we have to deal with asphalt in our air, the byproducts of asphalt in our air from... where some of the plants are located, believe it or not, right in the heart of the city. And so that and the other fuels and the involvement, as Representative Johnson was pointing out, the Lung Association making the connection with air, cleaner air. I'm just wondering, do you have a mapping of the use of our biofuels or the use of these alternative products by geography, by... You know, what I'm wondering is, are our cities making use of these? That could be, I would think, would be less. It's probably for lack of knowledge about the reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, do you have a map that shows, like, how are we using these? I'm sure that, without making any more assumptions, urban, suburban, rural, where are these products being used, and could there be improvement use in certain areas?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I would say there's a very comprehensive map in terms of locations of where that infrastructure is. So if you wanted to know where you could go around the state to fill up your car with biofuels, there's maps, especially I think on the American Lung Association website. So I would encourage folks to look at that if they'd like to, you know, use biofuels in their automobiles. I would say that in terms of our BIP program, we did try to do a wide variety of regional. We tried to hit all the regions of the state, including urban and rural parts of the state. So, and I would say that there's probably more work to be done in terms of just education and sort of a change in mindset about the use of biofuels. I think the general public could use more education on just the benefits of those things. And so that's certainly something that we're working on, along with a number of the farm organizations and our partners that we work with have done a fantastic job on that. I'm almost positive that we're able to maybe find some usage numbers, but I'll check on that and let you know.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark.
To point out, one of the reasons for that, maybe just to spur you on with that, is the number one cause of asthma in my inner city district is mobile sources. The trucks and cars that go through with diesel and other kinds of fuel emissions. That's what they've determined over the years. We have a lot of freeways cutting across, happens to be my district and other inner city areas. And I think there could be a lot more education with both the people who are driving those vehicles, but also with the communities who are being impacted about how we could have, you know, maybe more use of these agricultural products to protect our air, to clean up our air, to have less asthma, to have less other health-related issues related to, you know, the contaminants that are coming out of diesel and other fuel. It's not just the diesel, but that at least is one place we're making some advancements. So I just want to ask you to think about that. The American Lung Association probably, it's one of the things they know about and why they're working with you. But if we could get more of the general public to think about that, maybe we could get some better cooperation with that industry.
Another of the, just a comment on that, benefits of ethanol is that it produces a cleaner emission from our vehicles. And I read the other day that it's a 40% decrease in emissions coming out of our cars when we use and burn ethanol in our vehicles. So that's a great help. In Minnesota, you have to have your vehicles inspected years ago, and then we got into the use of ethanol, and it's really helped clean up the air. And we sometimes forget about that, the benefit of using that. Representative Johnson again.
Thank
We're
you,
carrying man. On the show here.
All right. Thank you. Well, Representative Clark, my colleague Clark, made really the case for the mandates. There's a lot of times folks are uncomfortable with mandates, and we raise questions: should government be making these kinds of mandates? But the beauty of the mandates in Minnesota is that no matter where you're in Minnesota, if the truck is on the road and it's filled up in Minnesota, it's driving on biodiesel. And so that's a uniform application across the state, and kids in my area benefit, and certainly in the inner city. And I think you make a good point, and this is where agriculture, again, can tie to the urban area. You mentioned earlier this morning in another committee, but I noticed it as well, there was an air alert in the Twin Cities. And, you know, and I thought about if you've got little kids, or if you've got, when I took care of my dad when he was out and about, and that's a scary thing. We get air alerts, by the way, down in the Mankato area due to our geography as well. But the emissions from vehicles is very important, and we don't want to lose sight of that, because that air alert had affected all of us who were in St. Paul, Minneapolis yesterday. I don't know if it's on again today, but that's real. And that affects the health of a lot of folks. And this is where agriculture can play a role, not only in the feeding of America, but also we talk about fueling America and fueling Minnesota. And the health benefits of the fuels, biodiesel is the cleanest fuel available in current technology. And so supporting that has the health benefits and, of course, again, the economic benefits on the farm.
Very good. And I agree. Ms. Bobble, as long as we have a couple of minutes, could you talk a little bit about one of the roadblocks, I think, to more use of especially E15 blends of ethanol, is this whole thing with the EPA and the reed vapor pressure. And E85 has a waiver, but E15 does not. Is there hope, and not getting political, but with the new administration taking over, what, Friday, hope to maybe change and get the EPA to waive E15?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The RVP waiver issue is a roadblock, I think, to growing E15 in the state. Governor Dayton has sent letters to USDA and our federal delegation asking for an EPA asking for support in granting that waiver. I'm not sure how things will turn out with the new administration. We don't know, again, who's going to – we know who the EPA administrator is, but we don't know who will be our kind of advocate at USDA, so we're still waiting to hear that, but it's certainly something that we're advocating for and keeping a close eye on.
So technically right now stations can't sell E15 except to flex fuel cars in the summer months, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking around. I would just bring up one topic, and this is not on the energy topic. We just came from the Property Tax Division Committee and heard a bill about reducing ag taxes on the farmland. And Representative Leon had a bill on that. And a farmer from up in the valley testified, and he made a comment that, that really made me think about the situation of ag land being valued highly. And he said he hasn't bought any land in the last however many years, so his land cost has stayed the same. But if somebody comes into the area and pays a high, what we call a high amount for land, that affects the taxes that we all pay on ag land. And it's that speculative market that, that has driven the value up and really has gotten away from the actual ability of that land to produce a crop and to come up with a profit. And I think therein lies the problem that how do you tax that ag land and yet be fair of the fact that when you make a change, you're shifting taxes. And we have the bill that would have the state pay the 40% credit on school levy capital referendums, and that's one piece of it. But it's a big problem. And right now in this current economic situation for farming and agriculture, it's really a difficult situation. Farmers still seeing their property tax bills going up and their ability to pay that bill decreasing as the margins just aren't there to pay these bills anymore. So challenges currently in agriculture and things like the biodiesel thing, if that can help raise the price of soybeans, it would help in that effort to make things work again better. But any thoughts or comments on agriculture in general, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing that up. I was actually thinking about ag land values when Mr. Connor, or is it O'Connor, Mr. O'Connor?
O'Connor
spoke, and we learned about his farm being settled in 1858, and he's the sixth generation farmer. And I was tempted to ask him a question. I won't do that. I won't draw you out here. But because this is the point I'm trying to make, and maybe Mr. O'Connor would like to comment on this. Because I represent Nicola County, and there are a lot of farms of that age. And there's a number of farmers have said, well, you know, when we talk about the value of the ag land, that yes, that has, obviously that has wealth within that family, but in a way, it's a shallow wealth because they're not going to be the one that's going to sell the family farm, especially if you're in the sixth generation.
Yeah.
So I find it curious that, you know, we have these ag lands. There's obviously a lot of wealth, and that is significant and has merit. But there's situations where it doesn't mean that you can market that land. And I think there's a lot of family farmers out there, and I can imagine that. I'm not going to be the one to sell the family farm that's been in the family for six generations, so no matter what the value of that farm is, in a way it doesn't have a market value. And I think we could go on and have an extended conversation about a number of things that factor into the value of ag land. I find it interesting, let's just for convenience, let's say a $9,000 an acre piece of farmland, which, you know, that's a little high right now, but it works well for my numbers because typically, where I live, that might rent for about $300 a year.
An acre.
Of which, an acre, yeah. And of which a good chunk of that is going to property taxes. Now, if you say that to any commercial, you know, if you put those numbers on another commercial enterprise, you know, they'd laugh you out of the room. It just doesn't make sense. And so this raises a whole lot of questions about like what you raised in terms of the speculative values, but also in the taxing of it, et cetera. And I hope that tax committee takes a long look at those. Obviously, a good first step is, I think we're all ready. I don't think we'd have any problem passing that 40% reduction in the school land construction tomorrow. Maybe my colleagues on the GOP side could find a way to move that, advance that forward as fast as you can. I think I know the farmers in my neighborhood would really appreciate that. We're building some beautiful new schools, and the farmers are paying an inordinate amount for that. So I'd encourage that. But I also encourage you to consider that maybe this is a committee where we could look a little bit at ag land values and the multiple ramifications of it and that the dynamics of that market.
Mm-hmm. And one comment I've heard from farmers, especially those that live more in the southern part of the state, they talk about Iowa. Iowa certainly has prime farmland, and we're told that the taxes on ag land in that state are $15 to $20 an acre. And when you cross the border into Minnesota, if you're in a district that has a high school tax, you could be talking $70, $80, $90 an acre tax on ag land. So we've asked to see what Iowa is doing. And when I tell folks, or when they tell me that, gee, Iowa only taxes $15 an acre, why does it Minnesota? You have to keep in mind that you have to raise the revenue somehow. And I don't know if Iowa has a sales tax on more things than we do, but you still have to raise a certain level of revenue. And whether you do that through a property tax or an income tax or a sales tax, you still have to raise that revenue. So I don't think Iowa state government is a whole lot, you know, more efficient than we are, but at least in the area of their tax on ag land, they are significantly cheaper right now. And you know, carry on a little bit further, talking about the ag credit on school referendums, and there was also discussion of changing that to just the house, garage, and 1 acre. And I'm a farmer, and you know, that would be good for farmers to have that reduction on these capital referendums. But last year, I was looking in some figures about school districts in Minnesota, and the one that stands out in my mind was either Wheaton or Campbell-Tinton. Now, that's way out in the western part of the state. And I think it was Campbell-Tinton that their net tax capacity of their entire school district was 96% ag land. 96% of their whole tax capacity is ag land. So if you take nearly all of that off the tax roll for building a new school, you'll never build a new school again. And maybe they don't have ideas of doing that, but just the point that when you make a significant change like that and drop from all acreage to the house, garage, and 1 acre, that would make a significant change in how you would collect revenue to build a new school. Now, that's how operating levies are levied, just on the house, garage, and 1 acre on ag land. But on building referendums, it's still the entire acreage, less maybe this 40% credit that we hopefully will pass this session. And I agree, sooner rather than later. And it's too bad it wasn't signed into law last year because we've lost a year as far as the farmers have to pay that higher tax again, now payable 17 taxes. I'm running out of things to say here, but looking at other comments, Representative Sauke. Close?
It's all right. I'll answer anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
I appreciate what you just said. I think it's got great wisdom in it, and particularly as we look at the large structure. And I just want to offer you all another window that you may not commonly think of, but I just came out of an occupation where this issue of functioning as if speculative value is equity. I owned a real estate company through the last 8 years. That whole structure fell apart because of people assigning equity value to speculative value and started functioning as if speculative value is equity value. And as a nation, we all drank the Kool-Aid and we all went down with it and had to reset. And a lot of people lost big chunks of money. Mostly the federal government stepped in and backed it up, and we as taxpayers did. So I think that we have to be very careful, but I also think that we have to be careful on the other side of the swing of this, in that as we start to give value to speculative value, that we are on very, very shaky ground. And I think we need to remember the last 8 years while we see a system going that direction. It's very, very tenuous.
Yeah, good point. And you being in real estate, I was thinking in that last committee, is there a way that we could assign that speculative value to land and take that off the actual production value, Representative?
Yeah, I have actually been thinking about that for most of the term that I was campaigning and that sort of thing, in a small, of a somewhat of a different context, but it's the same principle. If you think of a property in downtown Rochester, we'll just say that, because most people know that we have kind of a runaway speculative market going on right now. All good for good business purposes, and people that are taking that risk are knowledgeable investors who are buying speculatively because they think they can quantify future benefit and access to a future growth. So that's the classic process of why you would speculate. But let's take somebody who owns a 40-foot front old building in downtown Rochester, who is probably going to own it forever and would like to offer his building into becoming a historic designated property. Upon getting that designation, he cannot add to the building. He cannot change the building. The facade must stay the same, and he can't, like, sell the sky above it. You know, there are all these limitations, which, in essence, gets to your point. It removes speculative value. But the one thing that our assessors don't have is a tool by which to do that. They really have to go in and assess for highest and best use, and these old historic buildings have to eat the speculative market that they're living in. And so I think that there are, I'm going to be offering that, and so if anybody with more power and more seniority wants to run with it, you know, good for you. I will be getting it there eventually. But I'm going to try to address it just in that way. I think that you've also, in the past here, and again, this is my naivety, so I apologize for a stupid thing that I might say, but I think the concept of Green Acres is also in that space of trying to slice away speculative value from what would be considered normal ag value. So.
Yeah, good points. And when you get the bill, let me sign on to it with you. Anyway. Any other comments? If not, we'll move on to some scheduling issues and then let you get to lunch a little early here. Tomorrow morning, we're going to have a joint meeting of the Ag Policy Committee and the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. It's going to be in the state capitol in room 120. And we're going to hear about buffers and hear some updates from DNR, Bowser, state agencies, and then also hear some testimony from affected landowners as well. So Ag Policy members, a joint meeting tomorrow morning, 8:15, in the Capitol, room 120, with the topic is going to be buffers. And then next week, Ag Finance will meet, and we'll begin hearing, or that committee will begin hearing bills in next Tuesday in Ag Finance. We'll meet in Ag Policy and might hear some bills also next Wednesday. And then, again, Thursday of next week, the Ag Finance Committee will meet. So not hearing any other cries for discussion or questions, I will adjourn this meeting of the Ag Policy.